transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Up first is international artist manager Matt Graham. Matt works with Australian singing sensation Cody Simpson, and he fills us in on what his career entails, from touring with Cody to making sure they stay on track with their goals and objectives. Matt's job is definitely 24/7. We then speak to radio-turned-podcast hosts Humble and Fred. They talk about the differences of changing from terrestrial radio to being available online around the world. Gina Lee of The Love Zone is here, and we wrap things up with a remix from the Saturdays' What About Us.
Capture your need for sound.
Do you ever wonder what it's like to manage a superstar entertainer? Well, we are very happy to welcome to the show artist manager Matt Graham, who is the co-manager of Australian singing sensation Cody Simpson. Matt, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks for having me, Kelly. I appreciate it.
So first off, I wanted to talk to you about how you ended up in the entertainment business. Did you always sort of want to be involved in music management?
I would say I knew pretty early on. It really started to pique my interest when I met Scooter Braun in college. Scooter was a couple of years older than me at Emory University, and we met my first week at school, and he got me into club promoting and told me that really his end goal was to, you know, to be a music mogul. And I always had a huge love of music. My dad is a big music fan, played drums, you know, raised me on classic rock, and I grew up loving hip hop. And you know, it was something that seemed really special and different. And I was going to a great university where everyone was becoming a doctor or a lawyer or heading to Wall Street, and I just wanted to do something different and more entrepreneurial and something more creative. And artist management sort of melds all of those things. It melded my love of marketing and branding and entrepreneurship and creativity. And I also think, you know, managers generally tend to be sort of creative people that don't necessarily have the best outlet. So you're maybe not a great singer, or you're not a great painter, or you're not a great filmmaker, but you have these creative desires, and you hope that maybe you can sort of make yourself feel better by finding someone who actually has the outlet and helping them achieve it. So I think that that's a big part of management, is sort of having that inner desire to want to help somebody achieve their creative goals.
Now, can you talk about, I guess, maybe the learning curve that you had to go on to get where you're at now? Was it like, as you did, you know, certain jobs and stuff, was, you know, it just sort of a hands-on learning experience that way?
Yeah, it very much is. You know, there's few people in our business, and it's sort of sad, that are willing to mentor and put young people in a position to learn and win. And Scooter and I both, you know, we sort of had to figure it out on our own. We're both really young. You know, Scooter had a great mentor in Jermaine Dupri, but really, you know, we had to figure things out on our own. Even those types of people are so busy that just because you have access to them doesn't mean they're really taking the time to sort of like bring you along or teach you the ropes. And not to mention, there's a certain amount of like, you know, fake it till you make it. So you have to pretend when you're around those people that you know more than you do, just so they're willing to keep you around. And I think because of that, you know, you have to just rely on yourself to absorb as much information and take on as many experiences as you can. And, you know, guys like both Scooter and I, you know, we managed a lot of, you know, unsigned artists before we ended up signing artists and before we ended up having success with artists. So it's a journey. And you just have to be willing to accept the fact that, you know, it's very difficult to get it right the first time. And you have to keep trying and getting better at what you do and learning more and more and expanding your network and sort of all of those things.
Do you think it helped that you and Scooter were sort of in it together so that you had each other to lean on?
Certainly, like, when we were in college, it was great. Like, we were, you know, we were a very complimentary team. You know, he's the world's best hype guy, the best promoter I've ever met. And, you know, I was always very organized and very brand driven and, you know, we just complemented each other very well. You know, after college, I had to move back to New York, and he decided to stay in Atlanta, and he focused more on music, and I focused more on moving into working with big brands and doing sort of like music strategy for those brands, creating ad campaigns around sort of new talent. I was working at a company called Cornerstone, who owned the Fader magazine, and they're an incredible lifestyle marketing company that I had the privilege of working at for several years, and working with some great guys like Rob Stone and John Cullen and Andy Cohen, and learning a lot there. And Scooter was taking more of the path of, you know, a music manager. And, you know, he had some success with Asher Roth early, which then led to his, you know, incredible success with Justin Bieber. And I was looking at what he was doing, and, you know, we were in constant contact because we were such good friends, and was telling him, you know, man, I think I really want to move back into the music management side of things. I think it's just a great place to be in the industry right now. And we'd always talked about, you know, figuring out how to work together again. But, you know, management is more of like a solo thing until you have an artist that's so big that you have to have a team around them. And eventually I actually was bringing along an artist that I signed to Interscope when I was about 24. And that's when I left Cornerstone and the Fader, and I decided to create my own management company. And I did that for several years, and we had some success in getting some big deals done with publishing companies and performing rights organizations. And we eventually couldn't really ever get a single off the ground. But that whole time, you know, Scooter was impressed by what I was accomplishing on my own, and we continued to talk about working together again. And we just wanted to find the right project. And then when we heard Cody Simpson was looking for management, you know, we came together and we said, this is the perfect thing to do. You know, Scooter still hadn't signed at this point Carly Rae or The Wanted or, you know, Psy or any of these people. So it was still a very small company that he had. And we wanted to expand with signing another big act. And we worked very hard to sign Cody. And I think that, you know, it's eventually been a stepping stone that led to signing more great acts. And, you know, now I think 14 months later, you know, there's this incredible management company and record label growing out of, you know, what Scooter laid down, you know, with Justin and even Asher, you know, several years ago.
Joining us on the show is Matt Graham, co-manager of Cody Simpson. Make sure to check him out on Twitter, at It's Matt Graham. When it comes to your relationship with Cody, what's it like? Because you are, you know, his manager, but do you end up sort of feeling and acting also like an older brother? Because I'm sure you obviously develop a personal relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. We spend so much time together, you know, in a lot of ways, like, we have to be, like, each other's only friend on the road, you know? And it's been about 14 months, and I can say that, you know, he's one of my best friends in the world and feels like, you know, like family to me. He's like my little brother, and I think he feels the same way about me, and it definitely creates a different relationship than I think most artists and managers have. You know, part of that is how much time we spend together, and part of that is, you know, his age being young and not getting to have a lot of friends around him, and, you know, still sort of, you know, needing to have, you know, older mentors in his life to help him, like, grow to become a man. And, you know, I started working with him when he's 14. Now he's almost 16. And it's been incredible to watch him grow, not just physically because he's gigantic now, but just as a person and as a man, really, a young man. I love the kid very much, and it is very much a familial relationship.
Do you think it takes different skill sets to manage, you know, like a young artist like him and Scooter with Justin, as opposed to, let's say, you managing someone who's 26 or 27?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are a lot of managers out there that approach management like a job, and, you know, they use their relationships and their know-how to advance a person's career, and that's sort of where it ends. You know, with Scooter and I, we have to be parents, big brothers, teachers, you know, babysitters sometimes. Like, it's everything. It's this whole different type of job, and it's, you know, it's 24 hours a day. You forget, but, like, kids don't think of, they've never had a work day, right? So they don't think that at 9 o'clock, you know, maybe it's time to let Matt or Scooter, you know, sit down and watch a television show or something like that, or for me, like, spend some time with my wife. Like, you know, I'll get a call from Cody at any time of day, you know, Saturday, Sunday, 11 o'clock at night, and he'll just want to start talking about the album or songs or promotion ideas or, you know, choreography or whatever it is. And sometimes I'm just like, bro, I just need to hang out with my wife for a second. We just opened a bottle of wine, and I know you don't know anything about that, but I just need to relax for a moment. And it's definitely a totally different relationship, I think, than a lot of managers have with some of their older acts. It's just the general sort of naivete and mixed with an enthusiasm that comes with being a kid. Yeah.
Is it hard for you as his manager to sort of keep maybe people away who shouldn't be, you know, cozying up? Because obviously there's so many people that, you know, want to be hanging out with Cody or want to be hanging out with Justin, and they might not have the best of intentions. Are you constantly having to be sort of like a watchdog?
Yeah, you absolutely have to. Fortunately for me, Cody is, he's naturally skeptical of people. He's very shrewd, and he knows, you know, who's looking out for him and who isn't. But particularly, you know, right now, it feels like he's stepping up to that next level of a real, like, global superstar. And there's a lot of people that are coming around wanting to, you know, throw money at him in terms of, you know, taking him to the next level and making investments in him, you know, whether it's brands or promoters or, you know, whatever it may be. And we actually, we had a serious talk in Vegas a couple days ago after we did the Bieber show, you know, just about that. I think Vegas was a great forum for it because it's filled with those types of people. And I wanted to, you know, just remind him that you have to be very careful about who you let into your inner circle, very careful about what you say, very careful about what you commit to and things like that. And, you know, that ultimately he's the CEO of his company, and he has to be responsible for that.
Can you explain a typical day on tour for you guys and what some of your duties involve during that day? Because obviously there's so many things and activities going on, you know, when he's out on tour and when you're out on tour with him.
Yeah, I mean, generally when we're out on tour, you know, he wakes up early, has breakfast, maybe gets a workout in, does a couple of hours of school with his tutor, and then we have to go do, you know, radio promo, maybe go to a radio station, help perform a couple songs acoustically, sign autographs for maybe 50 winners or something like that, record liners, do a little bit of an on-air interview, then maybe we'll run to a, you know, an FYE or a Target or a Kmart or something like that where we're doing you know, some licensed goods or the album is in stores, and we'll do a signing of maybe 600 to 800 people. And then he'll head over to the venue. We'll do a, you know, a quick sound check. He'll spend an hour maybe working out again or stretching, doing vocal warm-ups, eat some dinner, and then get ready to perform. And then after his performances, usually we'll have to do some international interviews just based on the time difference. We often have to do them late at night. And then maybe he'll get an hour to sort of lay in his bunk and unwind and maybe talk about that performance and how to make it better and things like that. So that's a generally like a pretty normal tour day.
And are you constantly running and right beside him?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you a little bit just, you know, about Cody's relationship with his fans. You know, you mentioned before that he has to understand that he's sort of like the CEO of his own company and you're helping him sort of run it. How important is it in your mind, Matt, how important his fan base is and that he keeps sort of growing it and how integral they are to his company and brand growing?
Of course. I mean, they are the number one priority, right? Without a fan base, none of this matters. There's no touring, there's no endorsement deals, there's no record deal, there's no publishing deal, you know, there's no performing rights deals. It's all based around your fan base. The more fans you have, you know, the more money is generated. So as a company, you know, the profits are directly tied to how large and how committed the fan base is too, because sometimes you can have a smaller fan base that are very committed and go out and, you know, buy your music and buy tickets to shows and buy t-shirts and things like that. You know, oftentimes you'll have artists that have very big songs and maybe a lot of people like, quote unquote, like them, but they don't really care about them. They're not invested in those artists. They don't go to shows. They don't buy merchandise. They steal the music or they, you know, just stream it. And that's really the difference, is understanding how engaged and how dedicated the fan base is and then growing them from there, and also keeping them, making sure that they're happy and serviced, which means staying on the road, meeting them, doing meet and greets, you know, replying to tweets, constantly interacting on Facebook, posting YouTube videos, doing tiny chats, doing Ustreams, gift booming, whatever, you know, social media you use to connect with your fans. Shooting a movie like Finding Cody, an interactive movie for YouTube like we did. That's the biggest thing, is just growing the fan base. I mean, you eventually want to have a fan base, you know, like a Justin Bieber, that's just huge internationally, undeniably gigantic. And then you want to keep them happy.
Is social media, in your mind, sort of like the way of the present and the way of the future in growing your brand?
Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, it's certainly the way to create the most engaged fan base. You know, you can never replace the number of eyeballs that you can get from television, and the number of the listenership that you can get from terrestrial radio and things like that. But, you know, social media is totally within your control, and it's absolutely now and here to stay. I mean, it's anybody who thinks differently is, you know, just completely off base, and I don't think has a place in this business anymore.
And if someone wanted to get into the same business as you are, Matt, what advice would you want to give them?
First of all, you know, you just have to have the courage to do something different and not pursue a normal career. You need to keep in mind that it's very difficult. You know, there's more professional basketball players in the world than there are professional music managers. So it's a very difficult job to get into. And, you know, try to find great mentors. Try to find people that will help you get there. And if you can't, when you do, you know, break into the business, try to impress somebody and latch on to them and learn everything, you know, they have to offer. I've found lots of mentors since I've had a little bit of success in this business. And I've learned just an incredible amount from those people.
What's up next for you and Cody in the next couple of months?
Right now, we got to continue doing these Bieber dates. The album, obviously, is coming out today, October 2nd. We will be heading to do some radio promo all around the U.S. in October. We're heading to do We Day in Vancouver the third week of October. We're doing some performances at radio shows around the country in October. And then in November, we head to Europe and we do Cody's first European tour. Then we come back and he performs at the Macy's Day Parade on Thanksgiving in New York City. And then he will head to LA for a couple weeks to start recording his next album, which we would like to put out, you know, within the first half of next year.
Fantastic. And I would be remiss if I didn't ask you this question, because I know a lot of Cody's fans are going to be listening to this. Are he and Justin buddies?
Yes, absolutely. I think I just saw Cody posted a link that People Magazine did a write-up on them hanging out at the Goratorium in Vegas just a couple of days ago. You know, they go out socially in L.A. They've worked in the studio a number of times. They just have a good time together. You know, Justin doesn't get a lot of chances, and neither does Cody, to hang out with people their own age. And although, you know, Justin's 3 years older than Cody, he still is relatively his own age compared to some of the people that both of them are, you know, forced to sort of hang out with all the time. And they also can relate to each other, you know. They've had similar experiences moving from foreign countries to the U.S. to pursue their music careers and having success early. And you know, they definitely relate to each other musically and personally.
Now, I know Cody is obviously a main priority for you, or the main priority. Will you have a chance or, you know, time to actually bring on another act and do that as well alongside Cody?
Yeah, I have some things that I'm working on developing. Scooter and I have talked about some other ideas. I have some business ideas that I'd like to pursue. Outside of just artist management, and you know, Scooter has created a great platform for, you know, people in his company to achieve sort of anything they want with his support. And, you know, I don't know if my next quote unquote thing will be an artist or if it'll be more of a business venture, you know, working with Scooter. So we'll see.
Fantastic. Matt, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it here.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you guys having me.
That's co-manager for Cody Simpson, Matt Graham. Make sure to check him out on Twitter at It's Matt Graham.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
Rihanna has to be feeling pretty good these days. Billboard has recently named her the top pop songs artist of the past 20 years. Now, Rihanna has only been in the business since the mid-2000s, about 7 years. But in that time, she has managed to chart 34 songs on the weekly countdown since her debut with Pawn to Replay. Now, within those 34 songs, 9 have hit number 1, and 21 of them were top 10 hits. The girl has definitely been on fire. Now, rounding out the top 5, by the way, Pink in 2nd place, Britney Spears in 3rd, Kelly Clarkson in 4th, and powerhouse legendary singer Mariah Carey in 5th. And I have to tell you, taking a look at the list, it was actually interesting to see the comparison between some of these new cats, like a Rihanna, like a Katy Perry, versus some of the, you know, well-established acts who have been around for a long time, for 2 decades, longer than 2 decades, like a Janet Jackson, like a Madonna. Madonna was actually in 10th place, Janet Jackson in 9th. So they're making a strong showing, but it definitely is these new cats that are causing all the noise as of late. So congratulations to all of them who were in that list, but there can only be one winner, and that means Rihanna. And let's take a look back with the song that kicked off all of this success, Pawn to Replay, right here on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Yeah.
Joining us on the show are a well-known Toronto radio morning team who have moved their talents to the online world, hosting humbleandfredradio.com. Fellas, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hi, we're Humble and Fred. Welcoming to be nice to be welcomed.
So, guys, you know, we have a lot of listeners, who are tuning in right now overseas. So for those who don't know about you, can you sort of please explain how you guys actually came together to work as a team, you know, doing morning radio?
Well, this is Fred speaking. Back in the 80s, I worked for a radio station called CFNY, which is now The Edge in Toronto, 102.1. And I had been there several years as a sportscaster. And then it sort of moved into the co-hosting capacity. There were some changes at the station, and the program director at the time, Mr. Danny Kingsbury, had an idea for a morning show featuring Howard, who he had known from out west, out in Moose Jaw and what have you, and me. So he put Howard and I together. We met one day, felt like, there was some chemistry there, and the Humble and Fred Show was born in 1989.
Well, Kelly, Howard here, that's one version of the story. The real version is I was kidnapped by gypsies, and this monkey took me in.
Fantastic. Got it. I love it. And did you guys know right away, I know that Fred mentioned there was some chemistry right away, but did you have any inkling, you know, in your hearts that this was going to go on for years and years and years?
Well, when I first met him, I was hoping we would kiss. But it didn't happen. You're sicking me.
You know what? I don't know. You know, we both have the same sensibilities. We have a similar sense of humor. We laugh at the same silly things. And that started on, you know, pretty much the first day and has continued to this day today.
And
no, but at the time, you never know. Radio is quite volatile. But the thing is, CFNY or The Edge was a new rock station. And it was a good fit, the format of the radio station and the type of morning show we did. So it just went on for an extended period of time.
And was it an interesting evolution for you, you know, career-wise, as you moved from, you know, station to station sort of around that FM dial?
You know, I don't even like to think about it because we were at The Edge and we're doing fine. And then the company asked us if we'd like to try a project on the AM dial called Mojo Radio. You know, I was well into my 40s. Howard was in his 40s. The Edge was an 18 to 34 radio station. We thought, you know, talk about evolution. It might be a good way to evolve, do some talk radio for a little bit older audience. But the whole project went in the crapper pretty soon. So since then, we've sort of found ourselves, you know,
adrift.
But, you know, listen, we have had an interesting career. And now, like you, Kelly Alexander, we're heard around the planet. We have listeners in the UK, Hong Kong, Australia, the US, Canada, that listen to us on our podcast. And as far as evolving goes, this podcast is kind of a radio show we never got to do. And I'm not just talking about the freedom to express ourselves in any way we want. It's also just the freedom to talk and ruminate daily on things that are of interest to us that we know will be of some interest to others.
Now, do you find that doing the podcast, you have changed how you are as broadcasters? Like, have you opened things up a little bit more because you don't have maybe the time constraints of being on traditional radio?
Yes. We're doing on a podcast what we always wanted to do on terrestrial radio, but for several reasons, we're never able to do, be it programming, a program director, time restrictions, you know, playing a lot more music, obviously, commercial load. So, you know, with podcasting, if we want to go an hour 20 one day, fine. And if the next day we want to go an hour 40, fine. Or if we want to go shorter than that, we can. So it's, it's changed. Sure, it's changed our strategy and how you attack a show, but it's a lot more fun, I'll tell you.
And can you actually give us an idea about how much work or just maybe some of the challenges that you had to go through to launch a podcast? Because I know what I went through. And I mean, looking back, I'm happy I went through it. I think I grew as a broadcaster. But I think some people just think, oh, you're sitting down and you just turn on the mic. But I don't think, you know, I know from experience that's not how it is.
Well, you know, some of the challenges, the things that we, you know, met along the way were everything from, you know, setting up a studio ourselves to, you know, promoting it ourselves to deciding to do it every day. A lot of people, you know, for whatever reason, doing a daily podcast is a big commitment. It's a big commitment, especially in the absence of, you know, a lot of income. It's a big commitment to do the product and make it
sort of somewhat interesting every day. And, you know, we just decided early on that we would try and treat it like it was our radio show. We did that every day, and we decided we would try and do this every day. You know, I mean, all the regular things, would anyone listen to it? We have a lot of brand equity in Toronto, but one of the challenges we still face is, you know, running into people, as I did 2 days ago, that loved me and Fred on the radio and have no idea we're doing this podcast. I met a woman at an event I was hosting on Sunday whose eyes lit up when she found out that she could listen to us as simply as going to her computer. I didn't tell you about this. Mm-hmm. I met this woman. She was a longtime fan of ours, and she was sort of sad when she met me. She was like, oh, Howard, I really miss you and Fred, and it's been so long since, you know, I got a chance to listen to you. I said, well, you can listen to us tomorrow. And that's, I'm sure you find the same thing with your podcast. A lot of people don't get, for some reason, how easy it is to access content like this on their computers because they haven't been educated to the idea that the content that they're used to getting on the radio is now available at a couple of mouse clicks.
Right. Yeah, I actually had that experience just this past weekend with a similar experience where the lady was like, you know, I wish I could hear you more. And I was like, well, you can. And she was like, oh, wow. So it's interesting to sort of have to educate them. But I want to make sure I mention, you know, your website, where people can find you, humbleandfredradio.com. They should also be finding you on Twitter at humblefredradio. And, you know, because you guys are now business owners, I guess, you know, running this podcast and having the support crew that you have, when you look back on your radio career, is it interesting to know that, you know, later on in your career, right now, you've had to take on all this responsibility as opposed to just, you know, having the responsibility of just putting on a great show. You have all these extra things to deal with now.
Well, we do have extra things to deal with. We're pretty lucky. We have a lot of people surrounding us that have volunteered, that have come on board with an idea to be part of this, should it ever actually, you know, make money. Yeah, I mean, there isn't just the show to do, although it takes a good bit of our energy every day, but we're also the sales manager, the program directors, we're the promoters of it. But it's, having said that, it's amazing. Once we start the show, all that stuff is pushed out of our minds because I just think we enjoy doing radio or podcasting or just yapping into a microphone. So, you know, all that stuff that surrounds it is, I don't know. Once we start doing it, I just don't, it feels no different to me.
And is it,
you know,
a lot
like
of
carrying weight or pressure that you did before? I mean, I'm speaking for myself here, but.
And is it a lot of fun for you to, you know, because you have X amount of time that you are filling for the show, do you enjoy crafting, like, how the show is going to go? I mean, I know, I'm sure a lot of it is organic and you just sort of flow through your topics and stuff, but is it fun for you to go and figure out which guests you want to have and which direction the show is heading as you move forward in your, you know, online career?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I don't know. How would you answer that? The thing is, we have an act. I mean, seriously, we have an act. We have a thing we do, whatever that thing is or how it would be described. And, you know, it's developed over a couple of decades now, so we just do it.
Okay.
The thing is, we don't often share a lot with each other before a show either.
Okay.
Well, because we know how the other person's going to react, and if we shared it sometimes prior to the show, it wouldn't have the impact it does during the show.
Right. And what would you say to, you know,
that's how we craft the show.
Right. And what would you
say? We both have, and we'll talk about a couple things, like, you know, do you want to hit on this topic or that topic? But for the most part, Fred's right. We try and keep things as organic as possible. I know that I'll say some things that you might, he might find amusing or he'll have a take on it, or vice versa. He might just say something to get my reaction and know that I'll have a reaction. Or sometimes, you know, we'll, you know, once in a while I'll say, listen, I'm going to bring this thing up. Let me go for a second or two because I want to get this point across before you jump on it. But, you know, we've been broadcasting together for a long time. It is fairly natural at this point. Although there's always, you know, like I always find some things every day or every so often that still surprise me. And I'll, you know, that's part of the joy of it, that I'll be surprised by something he says.
Do you enjoy, with regards to the fact that you're online now and you don't have the constraints that you might have when you were on terrestrial radio with, again, you know, maybe such things as cursing and all that sort of stuff. Do you like having that freedom where you can maybe bring up a topic that, you know, in your previous life as radio broadcasters, your program director might have had a heart attack?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I don't know. You know, we worked for a new rock station, The Edge, and the reason they called it The Edge is because we were edgier than most radio stations. So
from that standpoint, you know, we had a lot of freedom at the Edge. And then when we moved over to Mojo Radio, it was talk radio for guys, we had a lot of freedom there. It wasn't until we got into a more of a sort of a mainstream situation when we worked at the Mix that there was some of those issues. But really, no, generally speaking, you know, outside of the swearing, of which we don't do a lot of, we do some on the podcast because we just talk like we normally would to each other, you know, off air. Mm-hmm. Just on the podcast, you don't have to be that concerned. So, no, I don't think there's, as far as our content goes, no, we're still talking about the same goofy stuff we've always talked about.
And what has the response been from your fans who now have found you online? Has it, you know, obviously they're ardent listeners for them to follow you over to online broadcasting.
I think the response has been a deep and joy that they receive from our silly content every day. No, actually, the response has been great. Anyone that has found us after either being a fan from before or a fan now seems to like this form of our show the best. They say that a podcast listener is worth, some people say, 13 times that of a radio listener. I'm not sure if you've ever heard that, Kelly. And the reason they say that is because the simple act of having to go and get you to go somewhere to make a little bit of an effort, even though we all know it's not much of an effort, mm-hmm. it's a psychological thing that if they invest the little effort that it takes in seeking you out versus just turning on a radio and banging around some buttons, they tend to respond in a way that I'm gonna use the word deeper, in a deeper nature than they did when we were just radio guys.
Okay. And, you know, for some of your former colleagues that you may have worked with at, you know, your terrestrial radio stations who might not be in the business anymore or who are maybe even still in the business but want to sort of update their careers and refresh them a little, what would you say to them if they decided that they wanted to do what you're doing and what I'm doing being online?
Get off your ass. You know, it's interesting. Since we've been doing this, you know how many former radio people or people not in the business say, yeah, you know, I've really been thinking about doing that. Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to do that. You know, and they ask questions, but they don't do it.
Right.
And that's the thing. Howard and I, from the beginning, right back to last August or July or whatever it was, we decided to do it, and we moved forward immediately. Bought equipment, found a studio, did what we had to for the studio. Set the sort of, you know, the foundation of what we needed going forward, educated ourselves. And then on October 15th, started doing a show every day. Treat it like a job. So that's what I would tell anybody. Stop talking about it and just do it. It's not going to happen magically. Mm-hmm. And it's going to cost you a little bit of, you know, as businesses go, it costs virtually nothing. Yet at the same time, when you tell some people you might have to invest $2,000 or $3,000, it's like, oh, geez, really? Like that's an issue?
Right.
I mean, seriously.
It's not so much the investment in money. It's the investment in, you know, a lot of people, comedians, radio people. The podcast is going to be one of those things, you know, you think a bunch of people are doing them now. In the next couple of years, everybody's going to have a podcast. The difference is, you know, the people that can fill content requirements are just as few as there are. You know, the people that can fill and make a radio show happen like yours or ours, it won't be any different on a podcast. The difference is, you know, we're all going to be sort of ahead of the curve here a little bit. But the real barrier to entry is what Fred said. Most people would say, I'd like to do that. And they do one or two, or they might try it for a couple months, and then you just don't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's I found that too, where to make that commitment and to keep going, a lot of people are shocked about the amount of effort that you have to put in to keep going and to keep getting better and to keep bringing in the listeners.
And you know what the funny thing is, too? I keep saying the funny thing. None of it's really funny.
Nothing funny, too.
Trust me. It's that age-old thing where, you know, when Howard often mentions this when it comes to stand-up comedy, everybody thinks they can do it until they have to. Like, there's a lot of radio announcers out there. They're very good, and they had great careers, find themselves at work. They can't do a podcast. They can't sit down for an hour and a half and talk. They just can't. Their whole career was talking in 20 and 30-second bites, mm-hmm. off and off liners or, you know, contests and stuff like that. It's not easy. So I think that intimidates a lot of people as well, especially if you're doing it every day.
Like, we come up with 90 minutes of content every day. Not to mention this terrestrial show that we're doing it on K-Rock in Kingston.
I actually wanted to ask you about that. You know, going back and doing radio, would you guys go back to doing it full-time?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we're doing it now. Filling in for Rogers in Kingston. And we, do three-hour radio show. We play six songs an hour. We talk for 4 or 5 minutes at a time. And, you know, I mean, if the gig was right and we had a chance to do it again in a major market for the right kind of feel, absolutely we do it again. One thing we won't stop doing, though, Kelly, we'll still do the podcast.
Good, that was my second question.
The podcast is, you know, what do you call it? Fred had a phrase for it. One is the art and one is the business. Or was the... One is the art and one is the... What did you say?
I forget. When did I say that?
A couple months ago.
Oh, did I? Hold on. It was a couple months ago? I don't know. I'll have to look at my notes.
One's the job and... that was it. One's the job and one's the art. And
right.
As much as we love doing the podcast, it really is the art. The idea of doing another major market morning show would be the job. It would be a great job, but it would certainly help offset the fact that the podcast is, you know... It's a tough thing to monetize.
Right, right. And what can we actually expect from HumbleAndFredRadio.com in the next couple of months? Like, are there plans to expand, to maybe add more shows to, like, I don't know, creating a network? Like, your fans, like, what can they expect to hear from you? And new fans that, you know, we want to help help bring more attention to you.
Well, we've started a network. Just added another show today, the Jeff Leeson Show. We have the Mike and Taz Show. We have Warren Anderson and Allison Dore, two comics, do a show on a daily basis, part of our network. They're all falling under the Hummel and Fred umbrella. And we do an intern show. The interns that work on our show, they do their own show. We post it on iTunes and on the website. So, yeah, we're offering quite the menu of shows at this point. So that's where we're headed. It's the Hummel and Fred Radio Network, HummelAndFredRadio.com network.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, because, you know, everybody's got their own show, but it all leads back to Humble and Fred and vice versa, right?
That's fantastic. And, again, do you have any sort of parting words of advice or just thoughts about anyone who might be listening right now around the world who, you know, again, is thinking of dipping their toe into online broadcasting?
Just, I don't know. I've said that. Just do it. Just stop talking about it. And you have to be serious about it. You have to look at it like it's a job. Listen, if you want to do it for recreation or fun or a pastime or a hobby, super. But, I mean, if you're looking at it to maybe be your job, you've got to treat it like a job. It's that simple from my perspective. I now defer to Howard.
I don't have really any advice. I think that, it isn't something that, I mean, not everyone's supposed to be doing everything. If you're a broadcaster, then that's different. I would just echo what Fred said. If you're a broadcaster and you think that you can occupy somebody's time for 45 minutes or an hour every day or every so often, then great, give it a shot. It really is. I mean, it isn't very expensive to get it started. And there's a lot of people doing it for a lot less money than we did it. We created our podcast to sound like a radio show. And so it has radio studio quality, but it doesn't necessarily have to have that.
Okay. Well, guys, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. It's been really fascinating to talk to you.
Kelly Alexander.
That's Humble Howard and Fred Patterson of HumbleAndFredRadio.com. Make sure to follow them on Twitter at HumbleFredRadio.
Stand by.
The Love Zone
with Gina Lee
on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Welcome to The Love Zone. I'm Gina Lee, and today's topic is about forgiveness. They say there's a thin line between love and hate, and the reason for that is once you allow someone into your heart and love them with all your being, that same passion and energy can mutate into hate when things go sour. A great deal of that hate is really just anger. Anger at the person, anger at the situation, anger at yourself for being in the situation. This anger can last long after the relationship ends, and if you don't get rid of it, it will affect the relationships you have in the future, may even prevent you from starting any new ones. So how do you get rid of that anger? You gotta forgive. Yes, I know it's easier said than done, but it must be done. Best to knock that chip off your shoulder before it takes root and grows into a big old tree of resentment and bitterness. Either you labor to get your heart right, or you forever struggle with the pain of never letting those wounds heal. And guess what? You end up hurting others too. So think of the journey of forgiveness as not only a gift to yourself, but to the person who you eventually have in your life. You get to have a wonderfully balanced and sane individual with no baggage, and you get to enjoy a relationship that doesn't live in the shade of past pain. To forgive someone who did you wrong is hard, because it may feel like you're letting them get away with it, but you're not letting them off the hook, you're just freeing yourself. If you have strong anger and hate towards someone, they'll always be attached to you, and even if they're no longer in your life, they're still in your head and your heart, taking up space and seeping poison into your spirit. It may feel good to hate someone, to declare, "I'll never forgive you for what you've done to me," but the thing is, you're condemning yourself in their sentence. Hate and anger requires energy and commitment, believe it or not. You have to remember all the reasons why you're angry and why this person deserves your hate, and that's exhausting. By reliving all the wrongs, you'll never get your head right, and you'll be weighed down in your heart. It's very easy to get jaded when someone you love has hurt or betrayed you, but one of the most effective ways of healing and moving on is to forgive them. If you can't bear to talk to the person face to face or on the phone, write them a letter. Even if you never send that letter to them, it will be an incredible relief just to get it all out. For the very last time, you can list all the wrongs and how it affected you and how you plan to move forward from here. And then you forgive them. You truly forgive them. You release them from your life. Release them from your heart. Because you know what? They're human. And we humans, we hurt each other all the time. And a lot of those times, it's because someone hurt us. We cut each other with our broken bits trying to make things fit. It takes a lot to admit our faults and to work through them, but having hate and anger in our hearts won't help that process. So just remember the good times you had, reflect on the lessons you've learned, and release the pain and anger. Forgive and free yourself.
I'm
Buzz Junkies Radio edit on The Kelly Alexander Show. As per usual, I want to leave you with your inspirational quote of the week, this time coming from Lao Tzu. Be content with what you have. Rejoice in the way things are. When you realize there is nothing lacking, the whole world belongs to you. Now, I am very excited to tell you who's going to be on the show next week. The amazing Cody Simpson. Have a great week. You and I'll chat soon.